Welcome in. Special edition, you got it, your rock and wrestling radio show. This is Beyond Ringside. Yours truly, Fast Eddie Lane, on this side of the control panel. I'd like to welcome in Mark Mabo Bowman. What's up, Mark?
Woot, woot.
That was probably the most original thing I've heard you say in the last 5 years.
You haven't even known me 5 years.
First off, 205-316-9900. Of course, the number to get in touch with us here at Beyond Ringside. Phone lines are going to be back open this coming Sunday night. Keep your eyes open on BeyondRingside.com for all of the information. Ladies and gentlemen, being joined by a very special guest at this time. He is the author of what I call a tremendous read and the book that I should have had in my hands before I interviewed Jerry the King Lawler. He is Ron Hall, the author of Sputnik, Masked Men and Midgets, the early days of Memphis wrestling. Ron, welcome into Beyond Ringside. Glad to have you on board.
Oh, thanks, man. It's my pleasure.
I had a chance. I've gone through the book 1.5 times, almost working on the completion of the second trip. This has been a beautiful read. I got to ask right off the bat, and if I can go ahead and lead off, how much microfilm, how many old papers, how much scrapbooking did you go through to get all the information that you came up with?
Well, man, I'm fortunate here in Memphis that we have a treasure trove of resources. And actually, I got into the wrestling thing researching my first two books on Memphis garage bands. At the University of Memphis Library, they house the old Press Cimeter Archives, which was an afternoon newspaper here that went out of business in 85. And if you were in the paper during their history, there's a good chance a photograph of you or is in their archives.
Okay.
So I would be up there looking for bands, looking for Sam the Sham or the Box Tops or something through these photo files. And I was coming up with pictures of Jackie Fargo, Tojo Yamamoto, and I would go, and it was bringing back all these memories.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, so I just filed it, and over the years of research, I started writing down the pictures that I would be finding. And I said, you know, if I'm having so much fun looking at this stuff, I said, I know there's a lot bigger wrestling fans in this area than me that would just die to see some of this stuff. And stories about, you know, Mario Galento, you know, getting in fights and shooting, you know, and stuff like that. All of it's there. So that was the easy part of getting the groundwork going. And then I contacted some photo dealers. I was able on eBay to buy a big stack of the cards of the original posters back, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago.
Really?
And they're pictured in there. And being a record collector, of course, I had all the records that Sputnik and Sputnik Monroe and Jackie Fargo did. And that's why we put a CD with the book. You know, to be able to, for people, because the Sputnik Monroe record, if you tried to buy it, would probably be $150, $200 if you were able to find it on eBay.
Right.
But people want to hear it, and that's why we put it on the CD, and it's just a trip. But it was hard to pinpoint. You asked me off the air about a mass team. And, you know, you get a photograph of say, the Infernos or somebody like that, that had two or three different versions of
right,
that.
Right.
And so that was the thing of trying to pinpoint who was the team in this picture.
Right.
And that was one of the bigger problems, just trying to pinpoint the time, pinpoint the era, and going with it and hope you got it right.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But it was just a blast doing it. Just the whole thing.
I believe it. Mark Bowman, come on board.
Now, let me ask you this. Did you have any input from either any of the surviving, you know, wrestlers from that era, or at least their estates? Did you have any direct input from them?
No, and I tell you why. I thought about that, you know, because I've known Jerry Lawler loosely for the last, I don't know, 7-8 years, we've crossed paths in other things, you know, with music and stuff like that. And I started looking around to see who was around, who was available, who I could talk to. And I finally saw that there was Lawler, there was Hart, there was Coco, there were people like that around. But then when you start I didn't want it to turn in to the Jerry Lawler book, the Jimmy Hart book, and just going by their stories, because that's been done. I mean, Lawler's had two books done. And so I just decided if I can't talk to a bunch, I'm going to leave it as simple as possible. What I wanted to do was picture as many, now I won't say obscure wrestlers, but people that had a good career that you might have forgotten.
Right.
You know, that might be in the back of your mind, people like Treacherous Phillips and Rowdy Red Roberts and guys like that that were big in my memory because they were so hilarious. Some of the stuff they used to come out and say, and that's what I wanted to picture. I wanted people to pick this book up and go, and not say, yeah, there's Lawler, there's Jimmy Valiant, there's this. I want them to say, oh my gosh, I used to love this guy. I forgot about him. And that's that's the main reason for this, because there's a lot of these guys whose life hasn't been like Jerry's and Hart's and some of the more successful wrestlers. You know, some of them have had a rough time of it.
Right.
And I wanted as many of these guys to be remembered as I possibly could.
One of the things I noticed was one of the pictures you have in there was one of the earlier cage matches before the use of the chain link style fence. They were using a chicken wire style for the cage. And a lot of us, I'm sitting back looking at it going, how in the dickens did this thing hold together? Especially when you've got a 225 pound man sitting on top of this thing, the structuring on that. And we look at the cages that are used now, whether it be in the major federations that are on national television or still the more independent organizations around the country. And just the way things are set up. And it seems like when I first started really watching the industry, they relied a lot more on pure psychology to build up storylines, build up fan bases, and to get people into the arenas. And that's something that I've always appreciated and admired. Now, when you get a chance to take a look back at some of the old footage that you've seen from some of the Memphis days in the surrounding areas, you know, was it as strong in that part? I mean, because I know you cover a lot of the 60s in the book, especially the late 50s, early 60s. Did you get a chance to catch much of the film storage on that?
Yeah, you know, the whole thing was that here in Memphis, it was more about in the 60s, it was more of building up the heat on Saturday and having people after wrestling, the box office in Memphis was just overrun with people wanting to get tickets for Monday night. And what sold wrestling back then were the storylines, were the good versus evil, and not so much about what I think it developed into is that it got to the point where every week there had to be a bigger gimmick, like the cage matches and the Wrestle Royale, you know, and the bigger, and then pyrotechnics and all that. Everything took over as far as the show. The show took over from the wrestling,
right,
basically, you know. And in the early days, I mean, it was there were old women. I mean, all these guys that we talked to, Lynn Rossi, even Bill Dundee has told he's been stabbed with fingernail files, and so because these fans were nuts about their heroes and against the guys that they just hated.
Yeah,
and it was more about the wrestlers back then than it was about what the show was going to be like.
About the production factors, yeah.
Right.
Mark Bowman, come on in.
Yeah, I just want to know, you personally, what was your favorite part of the book to work on? Which one did you enjoy the most?
Actually, I enjoyed the section, the Sputnik Monroe Billy Wiggs era. That, because to me, that's what broke Memphis as far as being a hotbed of wrestling. That one match to where, I forget what, 15, 16,000 people outside at Rushwood Park with Rocky Marciano refereeing. That match showed people, showed the other wrestlers that money could be made in Memphis. And, man, because, you know, before that, you were getting Luthez, you were getting guys like that coming into town, Dick the Bruiser and people, every now and then. You know, once every 3 or 4 months, guys like that would come in. After this match, and that was in 59, after that, I mean, it just exploded. And Sputnik had a lot to do with that. I mean, he was and still is such an iconic person here in town. And I think all through the South. I mean, if you ever wrestled in your market very long, the memory is there. And, that was probably my favorite section because that's, you know, that's what I remember growing up. I mean, I was just a little kid in 59, but in through the 60s, I mean, the people that came through here and, just the characters and stuff. I had more fun dealing with that section of it.
Now, there's one that I want to, you and I spoke a little bit off the air, and this is one that I wanted to go ahead and bring up. The era of the 60s and even into the early 70s, there was still a lot of racial tension and quite a bit still of racial separation, especially in the southern United States. Would it be fair to ask you if pro wrestling in and of itself, with the elevation of African-American black superstars, per se, such as Sailor Art Thomas, if that may have had something to do with the healing process and the beginning of a more unified time, especially in the sporting community, because in some areas they were still kind of skittish about doing certain things about crossing the race lines, yet professional wrestling seemed to step to the forefront. I mean, you had people like Tiger Conway, of course, Bobo Brazil, and like I mentioned, Sailor Art Thomas, not to mention some of the other great stars who had come through the Memphis area especially, including Rocky Johnson. But getting back to the question, do you think that that actually helped with the healing process to get us back together as a whole nation?
Oh, I think so. I think especially here, I mean, black patrons used to have a section in the balcony that they could sit in and watch the matches. And Sputnik Monroe, the black fans loved him. I mean, he would have a guy in a hold and would look up into the balcony and start white, like saying, "Come on, what do you want me to do?" And they would be up there killing Sputnik, you know. So he played to that balcony. And he finally, you know, he wanted the black fans down throughout the hall. You know, he said, it's not fair to have them up there. And so finally, they made a bigger section. They let them start coming. And one of the other white wrestlers said, he protested. He said, "Oh, you know, I don't want them coming down here. I don't want them doing this." And, you know, and Sputnik said, "Well, I'll tell you what. We'll just figure out how many black people are in that crowd, and you don't get paid with their money. You get paid with the white money then." You know, if that's the way you feel.
There you go.
So I tell you, because the fans got along great. You know, the fans could sit side by side, and they were yelling just as much at Tojo or Sputnik or whoever, they had that connection.
Right.
You know, they as far as the mixed teams, Sputnik and Norvell Austin was a great bridger of the gap there. And so was Len Rossi and Bearcat Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they because for years, you know, when Sailor Art and those guys wrestled, they had to wrestle each other.
Right.
And with the women wrestlers, I mean, there were some great black women wrestlers that came through. And the white ladies would be billed as a ladies match, and they would show, you know, whoever, you know, the moolah or whoever was wrestling. But then when the black girls, it'd be something like wild color girl match.
Yeah.
You know, like they were bringing them in a cage and letting them loose, you know, with chains around their neck and put in the ring to wrestle. I mean, it was, you know, kind of dehumanizing the way a lot of these, especially the female black wrestlers, were not given a whole lot of respect. I mean, they were given wrestling names like Princess Yubangi and stuff like that. And,
yeah.
But that changed. And I think it was probably in the early 70s that they started having, you know, mixed matches. And yeah, gosh, then they even started having a white male wrestler, a black female wrestler, and a midget.
Yeah,
you know, they wanted to cover all the bases, and so they would have matches like that. You know, a six man tag team and women tag team.
Hmm.
But yeah, I think wrestling had a whole lot to do with you know, helping because. Nothing ever came out in the paper. Well, not to me that it didn't happen, you know, as far as fights in the crowds among black and white. But from everything I've been able to see and talking to a lot of fans, that was one of the common grounds that they had.
Mark Bowman, come on back in.
Now we spoke about this off air a little bit, and just wondering, you know, is it true that that you guys are working on a film version of the book? And first of all, how's that coming along? And second of all, what exactly does it cover? Does it cover what's in the book, or does it cover what's in the book plus a little more?
Well, yeah, it's come along real good, and it will cover what's in the book, but a whole lot more. It basically is covering the early wrestlers talking about what life was like for them on the road. And, I mean, the stories are unbelievable. We had the, Coliseum here booked for a day, and the film crew was in there and, filmed Lawler and Dundee and, Jerry Calhoun, the referee, and it was just them talking and sitting there in an arena that made their careers was really it was really cool. And of course, Jimmy Valiant's on there, and Jackie Fargo, and Billy Wicks, and some great footage of Sputnik Monroe, and there's a section of him talking about race relations and how he could walk down Beale Street in Memphis and be followed by an army of black kids, you know, chanting Sputnik. And so all that is there, but then it goes on end to the Lawler, Dundee, Jimmy Valiant, goes on into their era. And some great footage, some good, you know, it's hard to find the 60s footage and the 50s footage. But these guys have beat the bushes, and they've come up with some I mean, from some of the families, they've got some. Well, there's a film of Mario Galinto and on a float going during a parade in some town in Mississippi. You know, he was like a grand marshal or something. So
really?
There's
cool.
All kinds of stuff like that, and it's. I think it's going to be good. It's going to be good for the older fans, that the classic fans that remember wrestling is one way, and it'll be good for the younger fans to be able to see who the guys were that trailblazed for the guys that came up later,
right,
and came through, and who the influences were. And I think everybody will have. I mean, you guys may have seen the trailer that's up on YouTube and everything, and it's just a lot of fun. It's just I've been really impressed with the guys that are putting it together, and hopefully by the fall it'll be out.
You're tuned in to Beyond Ringside, your rock and wrestling radio show, live from Birmingham, Alabama. Fast Study Lane, Mark Mabo Bowman, being joined by Ron Hall, the author of Sputnik, Masked Men and Midgets, The Early Days of Memphis Wrestling, available through Shangri-La Projects. And Ron is going to be making a personal appearance this coming weekend. Ron, you're going to be in Birmingham, Alabama.
Right. I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be at Charlemagne Records there, and from 1 to 3. And every time... We've done Nashville and Blytheville, Arkansas, and a couple of things here in Memphis, and it's so much fun just to, for the fans to come out and talk about their favorite guys, and we're really looking forward to it.
Now, at the first part of the interview, as I was introducing you, I made the comment about this is the book I should have had before I interviewed Jerry Lawler, because there are so many different things. Now, I knew that Jerry had recorded a couple of 45s. I personally never knew about the full-length album that he did.
Well, and the thing is, that album, the guys that played on it, I mean, were some of the best musicians in the city.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, Jerry got... You know, he went to Treadwell High School with Jimmy Hart. Well, he's a little younger than Jimmy, but 3 or 4 years younger than Jimmy. But knew Jimmy, and Jimmy was, of course, in the Gentries, which was a big group here.
Yes.
And
yeah.
So Jimmy put all the band together and everything, and it was really, and it's not a bad record. I mean, Jerry can sing a little bit, so. That's a funny, you know, you got all these guys that, I mean, Fargo did four or five singles, and Plowboy Frazier did one, and
yep.
Jimmy Valiant did one. I mean,
yeah,
I think they all wanted to be rock stars.
I think that rock and wrestling connection that everybody talked about during the 80s when the Federation decided to try to make that crossover, I think it was actually there long before Vince tried it, which is definitely noticeable in the book. Now, the copy of the book that I have, we have the CD with four different songs on there. One, of course, with Lynn Rossi, Jimmy Valiant, Jackie Fargo, and Sputnik Monroe. I'm going off memory. That's why I was trying not to cheat. But now, is that CD going to be in the book that everybody's able to purchase this weekend at Charlemagne?
Oh yeah, yeah. The CD is a limited. The first 5,000 copies of the book have the CD in it, and after that, the next pressing won't have it. So people are snatching it up because, you know, like I said earlier, all those records are. You know, if you tried to find them, you know, they're highly collectible, and the price on them, you know, is pretty hefty.
Mm-hmm. Now, first off, I want to go ahead and say congratulations. This book is a great read of a very historic era, actually more than just one historic era. And of course, Memphis wrestling has been known for many, many moons as one of the hotbeds in the southeastern United States for solid wrestling action. All the way through, the great state of Tennessee's always had some great stars come through it. This is one book that I recommend for real wrestling enthusiasts of all ages. You made a reference a little while ago about kids. This would be a great one for teenagers, for young adults to have. You get a chance, like you said yourself, a chance to see and find out a little bit more about the then stars who helped pave the way. We talk about having respect for the tradition in this industry, and I honestly think that this book will help you gain a little bit more respect for the true tradition in the professional wrestling industry with a lot of the great stars that came through, the men, the ladies, the midgets, all of the above. You know, I really did. I enjoyed it from start to finish.
Well, man, I appreciate it. I really do, because that's, you know, I just, that's the whole thing. There wasn't anything as far as for the Memphis area. And when I say the Memphis area, I might as well be saying the Birmingham, Knoxville, Nashville, Indianapolis.
Yeah.
You know, because all the guys wrestled in the same circuit.
Right.
So I think anybody in Birmingham will be able to see, will probably know 80 or 90% of these guys in this book.
They really will. Case point scenario, of course, Tojo Yamamoto, very well featured in there. George Gulas, the son of a legendary promoter, son of legendary promoter Nick Gulas is in there. And I'm going to go ahead and break this one loose. We talked about it off air. Of course, Tojo, now there's one that I wanted to ask. I don't know if, I didn't know if you stumbled across this one or not. Tojo was paired in Tennessee and in the Alabama market with a man who went by the moniker of Gypsy Joe. I did not see him in the book. Have you been able to find out anything about Gypsy Joe?
You know, he didn't. That was maybe a little later than when I the era that I cover.
Okay.
I stopped about. I came across some of him and Gypsy Joe, but I think it was more into the. Maybe the very late 70s or early 80s.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be about right.
Yeah. And I basically, you know, a lot of people say, man, I can't believe you don't have, how about Kaufman and all that? Well, this book was supposed to end right about the time that Jerry Jarrett took over the Memphis territory from Nick Gulas.
Okay.
And, it went on a little further because my editor is about 15 years younger than me, and he goes, oh, you got to have this guy. You got to have this in there. You know, he kept trying to get, I said, yeah, but you're getting out of my, now you're getting to a whole nother era.
Right.
And out of the, and again, the funny thing is it was harder to find photographs for wrestlers in that era than there was in the earlier. Because the papers here used to really, I mean, every Monday there would be a picture in the paper of a wrestler.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, there would be the whole card, all the results, and maybe another picture. It got into the 80s, and they even quit putting the card in the paper. Might just say there's be wrestling tonight. I mean, they basically quit covering it.
Yeah, we had that down here with the Birmingham News, our local paper in the Birmingham metropolitan area, for years. I think it was on Sunday especially. They would go. It was either Saturday and Sunday or, depending on the week, depending on the magnitude of the card, if they were going to have like a traveling champion come through, if it was actually going to be the NWA world champion, or if they're going to have a specialty match. But I know that on Saturday in the sports section, yeah, the Birmingham News would put the Monday night card and have somebody featured on there, whether it be, you know, depending on the time frame. I remember one time it was Dutch Mantel. I remember one time it was Ron Fuller. I remember another time it was actually Harley Race. They used his picture on that clipping to say the world champ's coming to town, or Ric Flair in the 80s as, once again, the world champ coming to town. Of course, I notice the fact you've got references in there to the Fuller family, the Welch family, who are, of course, iconic as far as promotions go in the southeastern United States, Tennessee, Florida, some parts of Georgia, a little bit of Mississippi, and northwest Florida.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, they were, they ruled.
Mm-hmm. You know? They did. case point scenario. Hang on. Of course, I also know that when Buddy Fuller stepped down, of course, Ron took over the book for Southeastern Wrestling before he eventually sold it out and became Continental Wrestling. But I remember, it's like for me personally, Monday nights, Boutwell City Auditorium, Municipal Auditorium here in Birmingham. And it would always be a solid packed house, and they would always work to put together the best possible cards for the fans in this area. One other person I wanted to hit you about real quick. Actually, two things, if I could. I'm going to take them in succession. Luke Graham, I knew him personally. I knew him more as Crazy Luke Graham. Of course, I saw one of the pictures in there that solidified the crazier side of Luke Graham. He was also, now I think this is the early 80s, so it may be out of the chronological range. He was part of a solid tag team in the Tennessee and Alabama markets with King Ripper Collins. Do you remember him?
Yeah, I remember Ripper Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
That team was again a little bit after,
right?
And that team didn't wrestle as much, I don't think, in the Memphis market as they did
Knoxville,
maybe in Knoxville or or Birmingham and on into the eastern part of the state, Chattanooga and into that. But you're right about Luke Graham. I mean, you look at the early pictures of Luke, and he's this Adonis looking guy. And then as he got a little older and gained a little more weight, then he just said to heck with it and went with a crazy Luke Graham. You know, then he was really nuts. But he was almost like two different. He used two different personas. Really, I think, during his career.
Now, if I may, I always ask the more established stars in our industry, as well as the legends who come on our show, about the territories and the booking style and how different territories complement them as performers and stars in our business. Out of the promoters that you've mentioned in the book, which promoter do you feel, and take the entire time frame that you took on the book, had the greatest positive impact on Memphis wrestling and made it look the most attractive for wrestlers, for workers and performers in our industry to want to go there?
Well, now this is just my opinion, and I've had people disagree with it, but I really think Nick Gulas and Roy Welch did more than anybody to make Memphis what it was. I mean, before then, it was kind of hit and miss. Buddy Fuller had it for a while, and what Gulas did, and I tell you what, you talk to some of these wrestlers, and you talk to Lynn Rossi and guys like that, and they don't have too many nice things to say about Nick Gulas. But then other guys, like Fargo, he said, you know, he was a businessman. You know, he laid it out, and this is the way it was, and but what Nick did was that he knew how to work the television.
Right.
And once he got the television thing down and was able to work the television market to promote what was going on with the matches, I mean, half his job was over.
Right.
I mean, it sold itself. And from everything I heard, you know, Nick was but a lot of guys say that Nick was the nice one and that Roy was the rough one, you know. But he said that, you know, Roy would, you know, he would, if some wrestler came in and griped about not getting enough good matches, he would say, oh, we'll help you out, son. And as soon as he left the room, Roy would tell Nick, he says, book him down in... down in Frog Jump, Arkansas next week. Let him see what it's like down there, you know, or something like that. So these guys, you know, it was almost like a monopoly they had. You know, they had a hardcore, I mean, a hard-handed approach at things.
Yeah.
But
you can't let the inmates run the asylum, true.
Right. And they ruled with an iron hand. And but I believe they were the... And a lot of the younger guys will dispute that. They think Jerry Jarrett did more for the because Jarrett, by the time Jarrett took over, and that's when it was just one sellout after another. Memphis had a string of, God, I don't know, 50 or 60 straight sold out shows. And, you know, that's when they're bringing in, you know, the every week was just an unbelievable, you know, card that was going on. You know, that's when Austin Idol and Bockwinkle and guys like that were coming to town. And but he wouldn't have been able to do that without the work that Gulas did.
Very true.
So So, you know, it was, Jared was fortunate and he did a good job with it, but he also just, he improved, he maybe improved on what Nick had already, you know, laid out.
Right.
But that's just my opinion.
And see, one of the things I enjoy about the book, of course, the scrapbook factor of it, you get a chance to see some of the legends in our industry, either A, in their prime, B, in their early days, or C, when they're first starting out. Of course, I'm making references. I made the reference to Tojo Yamamoto a couple minutes ago. Made the reference to George Gulas, I think we talked about, as well as, you know, I'm going to bring this one up, page 155. The picture of George Gulas and a tag team partner being spoken to by Tojo Yamamoto. Unless I'm wrong, and I really don't think I am because I remember that time frame, the partner in the picture is Bobby Eaton, who went on to be one half of the greatest tag, one of the greatest tag teams of all time, and I'm talking about the Midnight Express. He and George had a great run in the Memphis and the Tennessee, the entire state of Tennessee. I know they worked in Memphis some as a team. They worked in the Knoxville area. They came down to Birmingham on more than one occasion. Case point scenario, also one of the early pictures of a young Tommy Rich, former National Wrestling Alliance World Heavyweight Champion, as well as North American Champion, Southern Champion. Get a chance to take a look at the fabulous Fargo brothers, Jackie and Don. And I believe you even, if I remember correctly, there was, I think, one shot of Roughhouse in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Or Nuthouse.
No, yeah,
Nuthouse.
Okay.
whatever you wanted to put on him. I mean, he was, oh my gosh, he was a character.
And Southeastern wrestling fans, of course, in the Alabama market, Birmingham in particular, you're going to remember a lot of these faces because Don Fargo was here on more than one occasion. Jackie came through. We talk about the Midnight Express. Let's go back to the original Midnight Express, pre-NWA WCW days here in the Southeastern, continental area. And that would be Dennis Condrey, Randy Rose, and a man you've got in the book, Norvell Austin, who called himself the Junkyard Dog as well. Not to mention some of the legendary managers in this industry. You brought up Saul Weingroff. We've also talked, we haven't talked about Sam Bass, who was a manager for Jerry Lawler, as well as other great characters. Not to mention, for those who only know certain people from WWE television, you get a chance to look at a young Mae Young. So you get a chance to see what she was like in her early prime, because I know the picture that was taken, I think, was just as she was just starting to hit stride in the wrestling industry.
Well, we were real fortunate to get those photographs. There was a guy here in Memphis that in the early 50s would take pictures all over the city of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked wrestling, and he was able, through his family, we were able to get a nice introduction to the book with several of his, you know, 30 or 40 of his photographs, including a picture of Elvis Presley and his band in the ring playing before a match back in 1955. So yeah, May, that picture of May is, I mean, she definitely was May Young in
mm-hmm.
that picture. I mean, she couldn't have been early 20s, I guess. I mean, that's it's a real nice shot of her.
You make a reference, of course, to the King of Rock and Roll, Elvis Presley, and you've got a picture here of Penny Banner, a young lady that was romantically linked to Elvis for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was Mr. Guy Coffey, who managed the auditorium, said that Elvis would come down to the matches and would wait until the lights went down, and Mr. Coffey would let him in the side door,
yeah,
and have a chair for him there to the side where Elvis could sit there and watch not only Penny, but he from what he said, there was a couple of others that Elvis had his eye on, but he dated Penny for a while, but Elvis loved wrestling.
Yeah.
And would come often.
That is cool. I want to congratulate you again. This is a tremendous book. It is a great archive, a great history of Memphis wrestling all the way through 50s, 60s, 70s. And like I said, I'm looking forward to the film project. Do me a favor, please keep us posted on that. You've got my phone numbers. Now, before we wrap things up, first off, for our friends who are not in the Birmingham metropolitan area, what is the easy way for them to find out a little bit more about the book and pick up their own copy?
Well, you can do any kind of internet search under Sputnik Massmen and Midgets and find out a lot, or you can go to ShangriLaProjects.com.
Okay.
And that's the direct source to the publisher. It's also on Amazon.com, and I have it up on eBay.
Okay.
All you have to do is do a search of Sputnik Massmen and Midgets, and it'll come up. And that and my other books and whatever else that Shangri-La offers. There's a lot of other stuff too. So it's out there. You know, it's easy to find. And but I hope that a lot of people come out and have a good time. Good time Saturday, because I know I'm going to be up for it. It's I used to go to Birmingham quite often, twice a year for big record shows they still have there, and so I made a lot of friends down there, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, we're definitely looking forward to having you back in the Magic City, Birmingham. It's going to be this coming Saturday, April the 24th. Now, what are the exact times again?
1 to 3,
and that's at Charlemagne Records on the South Side in Birmingham, right next door to Club 1120. You can't miss it. It's easy to find. And actually, Charlemagne's been one of my favorite record stores for a number of years. They still carry a lot of the classic vinyl that a lot of people have just shied away from. And I think Charlemagne is a great archive in and of itself. It's like I go in there and get lost. When I go to Charlemagne, I have to go early because I know I'm going to stay late. And I'll normally end up loading down the back of my trunk.
There you go.
I get in trouble when I walk in there. But Ron, first off, once again, it has been a pleasure. Great having you on Beyond Ringside. Now, please remember, you've got an open invitation to come back anytime. If you've got another book signing or something like that coming up in the near future, keep us posted. We'll help you get the word out about it.
Man, I appreciate it. And we'll definitely let you know about the film. I think there's a lot of people looking forward to it, and we'll definitely keep you posted.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, the author, Sputnik, Masked Men and Midgets. Great book. Shangri-La Projects. Drop by. Pick it up. You will definitely enjoy this. Ron Hall, it has been a pleasure to have you on Beyond Ringside. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, man. It's my pleasure.
Folks, hang tight. We're going to be back on Beyond Ringside right after this.